like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi, Family Secrets listeners. It's Danny here to share a bit of exciting news with you before today's episode. We just found out that our podcast is a nominee for the Webby People's Voice Award in the category of Best Series. This is a huge honor, and honestly, it puts a spring in my step as I walk alone each day down into my basement to record my conversations with my amazing guests. Podcasts can be a bit like the sound of a tree falling in a forest. You know, is anyone listening? Does it really exist? So here's the thing. This is the People's Voice Award, so you get to vote. It would mean so much if you'd go to vote.webbyawards.com and cast your vote for Family Secrets. Thank you so much for hearing me out. I love you guys. Now, on with today's episode.
I had the America of my American father. He anointed our lawn with Scott's Turf Builder. He bought us frozen Cokes on the boardwalk at Rehoboth Beach. He brought home a late model Ford Mustang, a stablemate for our Ford Fairlane wagon, and lavished care on both. He flew the flag each Memorial Day and 4th of July, flaunting his citizenship so enthusiastically that I never believed he spoke with an accent. Even his friends insisted he did. The 50s gave Nico the perfect background in which to recede, to take on the protective coloring of red, white, and blue, to get on with the anesthetizing business of dissolving into the lonely crowd. By the mid-60s, he was raising three kids in a world where the Russian front had become a laugh line on Hogan's Heroes. I watched my father grow his shell hard and tuck his head in. I'm not sure it's a word, but he turtled.
That's Alexander Wolfe, longtime writer for Sports Illustrated and author of the memoir End Papers. Alex's story, as is true of so many stories we tell on Family Secrets, begins many years before he's born. This is a multi-generational journey of both privilege, survival, investigation, and reckoning. What is our legacy made of? How responsible are we for the lives lived by generations before us? Alex's story begins with his grandfather, Kurt Wolfe, one of the most esteemed literary figures of his time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Danny Shapiro, and this is Family Secrets. The secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves.
My grandfather was born in 1887 in Bonn, the Rhineland. His father was a musician, taught at the university there, taught music, choir master, composer, just completely subsumed by music. And on his mother's side, my grandfather's mother's side, she was Jewish and came from a long line of very prosperous Rhineland Jews, were great collectors of books and art. So between the music and the art and the books, he was just steeped in this Bildung, this cultivating the self through culture. And it was no real surprise, I suppose, that as soon as he hit 23, he was founding a publishing house. He'd begun collecting books as a teenager, really valuable books, some incunabula, really early valuable ones, and had an interest in literature too. He'd gone off to study, it seemed to have been the custom of the time, to migrate from campus to campus around Germany. He studied on four different campuses around the country, studying literature. So books and literature were going to be his destiny, however it came to be. Now, my dad is born in 1921, after World War I, and it's difficult to overstate how much Germany was convulsed by the war and the aftermath. So being born into 1921, not only did it destine him to be part of that cohort of males who would be sent off to war, Hitler's war, but it also meant that his childhood would be colored by the Weimar hyperinflation. Now, he did have the good fortune of being born into a family that was very prosperous, not just because of his father, Kurt's wealth, family wealth, but also because Kurt had married an heiress named Elizabeth Merck, the Merck Pharmaceutical and Chemical Company, known in the States as Merck, but originally from Germany.
Alex's father, Nico, is raised along with his sister Maria in Munich in a very comfortable life. They're taken care of by nannies and really not a part of the life and social world of their parents. So fast forward, light years later, to when Alex and his siblings are growing up in 1950s post-war suburban America. The whole scene is very Ozzie and Harriet. Hands-on parenting, dad has a corporate job, mom stays home. And the past is solidly where it belongs, in the past. But here's the thing. A lot of history went down in those couple of decades before 1950s America. For a German family with some Jewish roots, that history was fraught and complicated and not so easily erased.
Well, Kurt was Jewish to the extent that the Nazis would have declared him Jewish, but he wasn't strictly speaking Jewish in that his mom and her parents had been baptized Christian, and his father was Christian. Indeed, he was the choir master at a Lutheran church in Bonn. So there was a great deal, particularly among the upper classes, of this crawling to the cross, as Heinrich Heine derisively put it. If you were that invested in German culture and there was this roadblock to being a full participant in it, it was very tempting in 19th century Germany to abandon Judaism and fully embrace Germany and Germanism in all these ways. And it was the same way that Felix Mendelssohn had abandoned Judaism. The Nazis, of course, regarded him as Jewish and always would, but he not only became a Protestant, but he wrote the famous Reformation Symphony celebrating it. So it was very tricky. The cultural inheritance, I'd say, that my grandfather had was very heavily inflected with Judaism. His mother, I think, had more than anything to do with his interest in literature. His father was a musician, but because he composed and he conducted and played, his head was always somewhere else. But the inculcation of literature and stories and so forth came from my grandfather's mother. And of course, her being steeped in Bildung was the result of these very prosperous Jewish ancestors of hers.
I mean, one of the things that's so interesting to me, and I think that listeners will find really interesting, is this idea that there was this cultural choices and ultimately heritage that Nazis would not have looked at as, oh, well, this is now someone who is Aryan, who is one of us. because they've been baptized or because they've made the choice to fully adopt our culture.
Yeah, to the Nazis, Judaism was a racial construct, and there's no way one can simply convert one's way out of being Jewish. And the Nuremberg Laws in the mid-30s, when they were enacted, were an attempt to somehow sort this out, and my father and his sister were very lucky to fall on the more favorable side of that verdict. While not considered part of the German race and nation, were not targeted for elimination. By the time of the Nuremberg Laws, my grandfather had already left Germany. He had seen the tea leaves and read them, and was on the lam in Italy and southern France. With a German passport, he was ultimately unable to renew, but then was quite happy to just abandon Germany. But in abandoning Germany, he's abandoning his children.
It should be mentioned, too, that by that point, your grandfather was no longer married to your grandmother and was with another woman who he would later go on to marry, who was also not Jewish. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, yes.
By 1930, Kurt and his soon-to-be new wife are essentially on the run, ending up in southern France, Italy, and North Africa, while his children, Nico and Maria, remain with their mother. Kurt had spent the 1920s becoming a well-known literary figure in Europe as a publisher of Franz Kafka, Heinrich Mann, brother of Thomas Mann, and Karl Krauss, a Viennese cultural critic. These were artists and thinkers who were pushing the envelope. The new and exciting is what animates Kurt. But by the early 1930s, with the advent of Hitler in Germany, the new and exciting, the pushing of the envelope, and any whiff of Jewishness were all deeply dangerous. Kurt Wolff is restless, stymied. He grows tired of life in exile and decides to attempt a return to Berlin.
He's been in this funk. He's desperate for something to engage him. He wants it to be in the cultural sphere. And he understands that there's an opening in the foreign ministry for some cultural attaché position. So he heads to Berlin in late 1932, hoping to interview for this job. And he checks in with friends and some writers and ultimately interviews for it. But then by January and February of 1933, it's clear that Hitler is getting enough of a toehold that there's no way he, with his record of having published all these degenerate writers, to say nothing of his being half Jewish, he would not be a candidate for this job. And it was literally within the 48 hours after the Reichstag burns that he and Helen flee. They go first to London, where they get married, and then launch into this, what would be 6 or 7 or 8 years of exile before they finally land in the U.S.
In your book, you have this really lovely meditation about, like, it's sort of an inquiry, really, a question of what makes one know when it's time. You know, like when it's time to get out. In Holocaust literature in particular, I'm thinking about the people who just simply didn't believe that it could happen there or it could happen to them or that their privilege or their position would protect them. And it's just interesting that your grandfather, who had, you know, so much privilege and protection in so many ways, read the tea leaves and got out like really just in the nick of time.
I believe it's very rare. Anybody who has read about or studied that period of the 30s in Europe hasn't given some thought as to what I would do if I were in those shoes and had to make that decision. And I think for people who were vulnerable, under threat, but were of that upper educated class, who really loved and knew the culture that had been created in Germany, the German Jew who adored Goethe, for instance, or Mendelssohn, and just could not conceive that the people who had created this, that I love so much, could then turn and embrace this barbarity. And the quote from Bertolt Brecht nails it so beautifully, that the ability to figure out whether you have to get out now or you have another day or two requires that kind of imagination with which you could create an immortal masterpiece. And I think that Brecht quote nailed it for me and got me thinking about this thing that, it, as you point out, is really a kind of universal theme, wondering. We ask ourselves questions, you know, what would I do if I were forced to defend my neighbor down the street? but also what would I do to protect myself and my family if it meant forsaking this world that I'd found my place in and contributed so much to? And I can hear that particularly in my grandfather, who was so wedded to the German language and never, even as he published bestsellers in the English language, never mastered English. And that must have been just a horrifying break to make. And he did it because he knew he had to.
We'll be right back.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Kurt and Helen do see the writing on the wall, and once again, they flee Germany. Nico continues to see his father for visits during school breaks, spending stretches of time as a family while Helen and Kurt are living a stable existence in southern France. So their separation is more of a gliding path than a harsh break when finally his father and stepmother leave for New York. Nico is still in boarding school, his final year.
Where it really gets harsh is indeed 39-40. The war begins. Nico is finishing up his final year in boarding school after the invasion of Poland. And it's in 1940 that he's inducted. And 1940 is the year that Kurt and Helen are leaving Paris and heading for what's become Vichy France. And it's in 41 that they actually make their way via Lisbon to New York, which, as it happens, is precisely when my dad is inducted and is conscripted into the Luftwaffe and is part of the invasion of the Soviet Union.
Could you define the word Mischling?
Yeah, Mischling is a Nazi word for someone who is descended from Jewish descent. It's always so tricky, and I tried to distance myself from words like this by using quotation marks religiously around them whenever they appear in the text. But it's basically, if you're a first-degree Mischling in Nazi terms, you would be what we might call half-Jewish, that is, having one Jewish parent. And if you're a second-degree Mischling, you would be like my father, as opposed to my grandfather, which is to say, one of your four grandparents is considered by the Nuremberg laws to be Jewish. The irony here, of course, is that rabbinical law also considers people who are descended of Jews to be Jewish and that there's no converting out of it in the same way that the Nazis felt that way. But be that as it may, that was the nomenclature, the terminology. And my dad, as a second-degree Mischling, was eligible to serve in the armed forces of the Third Reich. There were about 150,000 of these Jewish soldiers who served in one capacity or another. And they were under threat. They were constantly changing definitions of who would be eliminated, who would be discriminated against. And there are academic studies that predict that had Hitler won the war, that even these partly Jewish Germans who served in the armed forces of the Reich would have been targeted for elimination afterward.
Imagine being part Jewish in a world dominated by Nazi ideology. A second degree, quote unquote, Mischling, and serving the Third Reich. What parts of yourself would you have to bury, to put on hold, to decimate? During the war, just after he graduates high school, Nico is drafted into the Luftwaffe. He participates in the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, driving a Jeep with target maps and reconnaissance photos for a fighter squadron. For a while, he holes up in the Ukraine, but then it begins again, and he's sent into active duty. And in 1944, he's assigned to anti-aircraft battery in the Battle of the Bulge. The following year, he's taken prisoner by American forces and sent to a U.S. POW camp in France. When it's all over, he returns to his mother's home, so estranged from himself that he doesn't simply walk in. He rings the doorbell. This is the history he brings with him to America when Kurt is finally able to send for him. And this is the history he carries as he starts his family and embarks on the American dream. What did you know growing up in Princeton, New Jersey, of your father's history?
I knew as a boy that my father had fought in World War II, just as so many fathers of so many of my playmate friends had fought in World War II. And I knew all along that he had been on the other side and very quickly knew that he'd been on the wrong side. And he never trimmed or concealed that in any way from me. If you were a boy of 9, 10, 11 years old growing up in central New Jersey in the late 60s, you would play army sometimes. And I would sometimes play army on the wrong side of it. I was acutely aware. The moral implications of all that would be a long time in setting in with any kind of nuance. But no, I did know that. But I also knew that my mother had planted a victory garden growing up in Connecticut. And I knew, too, that my grandfather had been essentially chased over to the U.S. So there was this vague sense that there had been these two very divergent paths. But for some reason, when I considered my father and grandfather, I never entertained the idea that my grandfather had in any way abandoned my father. And then when I happened upon particularly my Aunt Maria's letters and just some of the resentments that she nurtured for the rest of her life, I get a sense that it was real, that that sense of abandonment was very real for her. And I think in my dad's case, there was so much redemption. There was such a sense of a fresh start that he was able to embrace by emigrating. And when he emigrated, and it was just as the 50s were going to launch that generation of Americans and immigrants on this great path of success. And that allowed him to put everything behind. So he wasn't rehearsing these resentments for me.
Maria and Nico had very different paths. Many siblings do, but theirs diverge in stark ways, perhaps the starkest of which is that Maria remains in Germany, whereas Nico emigrates to the States.
That's so interesting, the way that two people, you know, two siblings coming from the same parents and the same environment, you know, the same childhood, can end up with such different narratives for different reasons. It's always the case with siblings. It's as if they have had different parents in some way. But there's a moment where you write, "I never felt like a child raised post-traumatically." And that struck me so hard because there's so much trauma in both your grandfather's story and your father's story. It seems something of a triumph to not have had that trauma extend to you, but it was the turn of phrase, you know, raised post-traumatically, which to me really means that your father and your mother didn't raise you with that being a specter. And that, you know, it's funny because, I mean, this is a podcast called Family Secrets, but this is actually a case where it makes me wonder if Nico had kept that a secret, if he had been deeply ashamed of his service and that shame had caused him to tuck it away, you know, to put it somewhere where his children wouldn't know about it, that then you would have been raised post-traumatically, if that makes any sense.
It makes all sorts of sense. And one of the things that I came to realize in a very profound way was, the more I thought about it and rooted around in my dad's letters, is that he was so forward-looking, and I think to a fault in some ways, but being forward-looking meant that, okay, what can I do now as I go forth with my life to atone in some ways for this chapter, which for no fault of my own, I was caught up in. And I'm struck anew at how much he was devoted to the cause of peace between the Soviet Union and the U.S. during a time when that wasn't to be taken for granted. And he was obsessively interested in the Russian people. He loved reading Nabokov. He participated in exchange programs with Soviet citizens. It was almost as if he needed to get on the ground. You know, here he had been supplying maps and photographs for a Luftwaffe squadron during the invasion of the Soviet Union. And as he hit his late middle age, he was engaging himself with the descendants of these very people. And that's a way of spinning it forward, really, I think, rather than wallowing or being shackled by the past. Now, I think part of it was he was dropped into a United States in 1948 that was putting the war behind it. I mean, the economy and everybody's orientation was entirely spun forward. And here he's living in suburbia and he has an American wife and three kids. And me being the eldest and the only male, I mean, it was face forward, boy, and embrace this country and all these opportunities that are here, as he was doing. You know, that's what he modeled for me. And then there's this imposition of our next door neighbor who works for the Boy Scouts of America and is slipping me copies of Boy's Life. And all I want to do is become a member of the Boy Scouts. And my dad has to explain to me that he's not a big fan of the idea of me becoming a member of the Boy Scouts, wearing a uniform and pledging some oath and insignia and secret handshakes or whatever it might be. And he did. I do remember this, him explaining that, yeah, I was in the Hitler Youth. And there's a downside to this. And there was a real sense of, oh, I have a second chance. I've been given the grace of a second chance, and I'm going to try to get it right, not just for myself, but for my kids, too.
We'll be back in a moment with more Family Secrets.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Nico is able, for the most part, to put his experiences in the war behind him, in part because of the time and place of post-war America, and in part because of his own temperament. I think many of us have a natural set point as either forward-looking or backward-looking. Nico is definitely forward-looking. He isn't forgetting or sloughing off the past as much as he is learning and moving forward from it. In a beautiful passage in Alex's book, he writes, "We are raised to regard shame as something to avoid or bury, not to speak about. But shame can be a great, animating, activating force if we let it." All of this is encapsulated in a German word I wouldn't dare try to pronounce because it's about 9,000 syllables long, but I'll ask Alex to share it with us.
The word is Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, which...
I'm sorry.
Believe me, I've had a chance to learn how to pronounce it with a little bit of grace. Vergangenheit is the past. And Aufarbeitung is literally working something off. So working off the past. And I have to credit Susan Neiman and her remarkable book, Learning from the Germans, for introducing me to a lot of these concepts. There's somebody that Susan's worked closely with, a German named Jan-Philipp Winzma, who really came up with this idea that we can take shame and kind of mold it and repurpose it. And I think this is where I tip my hat to the Germans and to modern Germany, because when you look at the ways in the public sphere, the Nazi catastrophe has been repurposed so it can be a lesson of never forget and never again. There are these memorials, these Gedenkstätte, which are the German word for a place of reflection. The ways that the German people engage with their past on a daily basis, and perhaps nothing more profound than these stumbling stones, the Stolpersteine that are embedded in the sidewalks of Berlin and many other German cities to memorialize individuals who were targeted by the Nazis and eliminated by the Nazis. And I think what shame does, and I watched the Germans over this year spent in Berlin do this, is it, okay, this is the past that's been handed down to me. These are things that I'm willing to accept and embrace and improve upon. We're big on that in the States, certainly, taking our past and trying to perfect the American story, you know, and bend that arc toward justice. But then there are things that I'm going to reject. And Susan Neiman in her book makes such a great case of that part of growing up is taking those things from your parents and sifting through them and then deciding what you're going to accept and what you're going to reject. And the Germans have done this, I think, in a civic way on a large scale in this extremely admirable fashion. And I think, and Brian Stevenson has done such good work with this down in Alabama with his project on lynching. And we really, if there were a way that we could build a civic culture in the U.S. that allows us to grapple with slavery and Jim Crow in that same way, where there's no debate over whether this is shameful, we accept that. And unfortunately, where we are in the States right now is there seems to be some lingering debate over what's shameful. And that's a great lesson, I think, in Susan's book, Learning from the Germans. She's braided these two national shames and tried to instruct Americans about it. And the proof of how successful she is, I think, and how successful the Germans are, is that the German people are appalled when they learn the title of this book that Susan has chosen. But there's something that we Germans can teach others that's outrageous. You know, we're still humbling ourselves from the way we betrayed humanity during the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah, it strikes me almost as our shame is actually the thing that makes us debate whether there's any reason to be ashamed.
Yeah, yeah, no, because we're not accustomed to abasing ourselves before anybody. As a nation, we're not. We're not into that. We ride high and ride astride the rest of the world. And one of the things I took away from a year in Germany and talking to Germans, including my relatives, was that there's great grace and power and to be embraced in the humility of acknowledging that you have something to be ashamed about.
You picked up, you know, with your family and you moved to Germany for a year to do the research into your father's past. Was there a moment that you knew this was something that you needed to do and, or a series of moments, or was it something that you knew for a long time that you would eventually want to really excavate?
It was probably a confluence of three things. I watched the magazine I'd worked for 36 years, sort of bleed staff, and became part of that exodus, which was in 2016, which of course is the same year that Donald Trump was elected. Which I think brought into very sharp focus for me that maybe America isn't so exceptional, that maybe there are these parallels to what happened in Germany. But then also, you know, to be perfectly honest, the fact that these ancestors of mine were dead, I think liberated me in a way. And I still had a cousin and an uncle who were still very invested in that generation. And I knew if I could get them on board to share archival stuff that they controlled, that I could really do some important work. And they both have been so supportive. I'm incredibly grateful to them both. The cousin is in Munich and the uncle is over a mountain range here in Vermont. And there's a real simple truth in archives. I have dealt with archives a great deal in my journalistic career and get more and more comfortable in burying myself in them. But I knew that this had to be more than that, that I had to find living, breathing people too. And I was so grateful to find them in my cousin Jan and another cousin, Nico, who's exactly my age and has wrestled with some of these things. You know, he's had enormous privilege as a merc in Germany, but he's also has a real conscience and has tried to change the world in his own way. And long conversations with him in Berlin. Berlin's a great town for long conversations. And it all came together. And I also knew that I'd been kind of running from stuff for 36 years, that being a staff writer for Sports Illustrated, during that period I worked there was really a joyride. I mean, there were so many exciting things, and I knew that there was something in the past to turn back to and take the measure of. And I've got to say, there was one thing, and I heard it in Ariana Neumann's episode with you too. There was this moment where she felt she had been given permission by her father to go back and tell his family story. And when my father and I in 1996 took this Danube River cruise, which was really the most, we dug into his past and I asked him the toughest questions. At one point in a lull in our conversations, he said, maybe you'll write about this.
This is huge, this idea of permission, not just for writers, but for all of us. We, the survivors, the ancestors, the ones left to tell the story, we long for that elusive permission, that sense that it's really okay. And it's so rare for that permission to literally be granted. This was also true with my guest in season 3 of this podcast, Ariana Neumann, whose father left her a box after his death, an actual box filled with his story, essentially bequeathing it to her. If you haven't listened to Ariana's episode, I hope you'll go back and find it later.
Permission.
I took it as that. I took it as permission. And of course, the fact that all these letters and my father's denazification questionnaire and his certificate of Aryan ancestry, all this stuff is still sitting around.
What is a denazification questionnaire?
So in the immediate post-war, every German citizen above a certain age was asked to fill out a questionnaire with 130 plus questions on it about your past and political and otherwise, as my dad called it. And the important thing was to determine who had actually been a Nazi. And they had 5 different classifications of how implicated you were. And simply by dint of having been in the armed services, my dad had to fill out the questionnaire. And he had been in the Hitler Youth because everyone at his boarding school had been in the Hitler Youth. And when he studied at the university, there was a German Students Union that was a Nazi party organization he had to be a part of too, in order to study. But he had never been a member of the party. And this allowed him to apply for a student visa, and the intercession of my grandfather, who by then was an American citizen in 1948, allowed him to come over to the States to do graduate work in chemistry. But yeah, all these documents were still there moldering away, and they called to me, the photographs. My dad was he loved technology. His Leica was his favorite little gadget, and his mom would send him film when he was deployed around Europe. We'd take pictures and send them back, and she saved every letter, every photo. And my dad, this is further permission, my dad translated all his letters for my sisters and me before he died, and I think he wanted us to know.
One of the most difficult things for Alex to process had to do with Nico's letters home describing in detail how well he was eating during his early days in Hitler's army. When the Nazis were in power, the idea was to eat everything in sight.
When the Nazis were riding high and they were taking everything they could out of the Ukraine, he and his fellow soldiers, not to say the also civilians back in Germany, were eating just scandalously well. And it was only after I got to Berlin and started to read that I realized that this was all part of a genocidal plan to starve the native population. It wasn't just to feed German soldiers. It was also to eliminate Slavs who were subhuman and Jews who were subhuman and just decolonize, basically, this swath of Eastern Europe, which would become eventually resettled by German farmers and annexed to the Reich. And to read the history alongside my dad's letters is to just, you know, just to start to cry.
Then later, food became scarce, particularly during Nico's time in the American POW camp.
I think the enduring part of my dad's wartime experience that we would see was around the dinner table when his appetite would be on display. So when I say I was raised post-traumatically, I suppose that might have been the one exception, because he did have a relationship with food that made it clear to anyone who really thought about it that there was a time in his life that he didn't have enough.
Do you feel that you got to know your father better through the reading of, I mean, you know, sort of this extraordinary body of personal writing that he left behind? Did you feel like you were adding another layer to your understanding of him?
Yeah, I think his letters home, they're very practical. I recognize his personality in every single one of them. So I didn't really learn anything new about who he was, but I was able to see, okay, he went through all this and he kept my sisters and me protected from it throughout his life as a father and a husband. And I think that was the revelation to me, was just the lengths that he went to make sure that we wouldn't be troubled by his own trauma. And he knew how lucky he was to have landed in the U.S., that a father he may have resented for having abandoned him then worked really hard to bring him over and help set him up, which I think squared accounts between him and his father in a way that my Aunt Maria never entirely squared accounts with her father. So yes, I did gain a real appreciation for the way he ran interference for us. And he was really scrupulous about sharing with us, I say this in the book, sharing with us really only the beauty, and you know, whether it was books or art or music. And I do caricature him a little bit as a child and an adolescent, as just this techie who didn't really care the way his sister did, or his father certainly, about art and fine things. But he came around to all that and loved music and loved art and loved the well-written novel. So he had plenty to live for and embrace and know that even as he was in these horrific places, that there was something back in Munich that was being kind of preserved behind the walls of the house where he had grown up in. And I think that's the nexus point between my dad's experience and the experience of so many German Jews for me, because they were every bit as invested in this German culture and helped create it. And this was the world that my dad had grown up in, first destroyed by the Nazis on a cultural level, and then was destroyed from the air by the Allies, because there really didn't seem to be any other way to bring the Third Reich to heel than to just destroy Germany, full stop.
In Alex's treasure trove of letters, there is one Nico wrote to Kurt after visiting Darmstadt, a town where his mother had grown up, shortly after the war had ended. Nico uses arresting language to describe Darmstadt. Oozing rubble like thick porridge. Ruinous. In the summer of 1995, Nico takes Alex's youngest sister on a cruise through the Mediterranean, where they stop at the scattered ruins of Ephesus. Nico separates himself from the group, takes a seat along this ancient plaza, and begins to weep. It seems that the markers of a civilization laid bare, that rubble, undoes a seam inside of him and opens up his own history.
I don't think there's any question that my father's reaction at Ephesus was a flashback. You know, the trip was a kind of taking stock, a valedictory tour with daughter, and, you know, his mortality very much on his mind. And he and Kathy didn't discuss explicitly the reason for his breakdown and him revealing all that emotion, but I don't think there's any question that it was tying into Darmstadt. And indeed, the home in which his mother had grown up was a ruin. And he describes it in this letter to his father in great detail. And the pipes clanking on the outside and a bathtub just exposed to the world, and his great uncle stooped and ruined and living in a garden shed. And these things just don't leave you. And he had concealed them all so well. And the last thing I ever said to him before he died, where I knew that he was conscious and processing it, was I just told him that your life has been a miracle. And it was, yes, he talked about how he'd escaped death a number of times, and it was that, of course, but really I think the miracle that I was referring to, he nodded his assent, I think he understood, was the way he had reconstituted a life for himself as an immigrant.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartMedia. Dylan Fagan and Beth Ann Macaluso are the executive producers. Andrew Howard is our audio editor. If you have a secret you'd like to share, leave us a voicemail, and your story could appear on an upcoming bonus episode. Our number is 1-888-SECRET-0. That's secret and then the number 0. You can also find us on Instagram at Danny Writer, Facebook at facebook.com/FamilySecretsPod, and Twitter at FamSecretsPod. And if you want to know about my family secret that inspired this podcast, check out my New York Times bestselling memoir, Inheritance.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.